An hour or so later he woke again. The same tread, pacing to and fro, could still be heard directly overhead. The reflection still graced the wall, but it was now pale and peaceful, like the reflection from a lamp or a candle. The window was still open. This is what was happening in Monsieur Madeleine's bedroom. A Storm on the Brain. The reader has no doubt worked out that Monsieur Madeleine was none other than Jean Valjean. We have already delved into the depths of that man's conscience. The moment has come to delve a little deeper. We do not do so lightly, without emotion or without trembling. There is nothing more terrifying than this kind of contemplation. The mind's eye can find nothing more dazzling or dark anywhere outside mankind. It cannot fix on anything more fearful, more complex, more mysterious, or more infinite. There is a spectacle greater than the sea, and that is the sky. There is a spectacle greater than the sky, and that is the human soul. To write the poem of the human conscience, were it only that of a single man, were it only that of the most insignificant man, would be to meld all epics into one superior epic, the epic to end all. Conscience means the chaos of chimeras, of lusts and temptations, the furnace of dreams, the den of ideas we are ashamed of. It is the pandemonium of sophisms. It is the battlefield of passions. Pierce through the livid face of a human being at certain moments as they ponder. Look behind the facade. Look into the soul. Look into the darkness. There, beneath the outer silence, titanic struggles are taking place as in Homer, melees of dragons and hydras and swarms of phantoms as in Milton, visionary spirals as in Dante. What a somber thing is this infinity that each man carries within him, and against which he measures in despair what his brain wants and what his life puts into action. Dante Alighieri came upon a sinister door one day and hesitated before it. Here stands another door before us, on the threshold of which we hesitate. Let's go in anyway. We have very little to add to what the reader already knows about what happened to Jean Valjean since the Petit Gervais episode. From that moment, as we saw, he was a different man. What the bishop had wanted him to become, he became. This was more than a transformation. It was a transfiguration. He managed to vanish, sold the bishop's silver, keeping only the candlesticks as mementos, crept from town to town, travelled across France, turned up in Montreuil-sur-Mer, had the bright idea we've mentioned above, achieved what we've outlined, managed to make himself unassailable and inaccessible, and from then on, well established in Montreuil-sur-Mer, happy to feel his conscience burdened by his past and the first half of his existence belied by this new phase, he lived a quiet life, reassured and hopeful, having only two concerns, to hide his name and to sanctify his life, to escape the clutches of men and to return to God. These two concerns were so closely linked in his mind that they were inseparable. They were both equally absorbing and imperious and governed his every act. Normally they were in harmony, regulating the way he led his life. They turned him toward a life lived in the shadow. They made him benevolent and true. They gave him the same counsel. But sometimes there was a conflict between them. When this happened, as you will recall, the man the whole countryside called Monsieur Madeleine did not waver in sacrificing the first to the second, his security to his virtue. And so, in spite of all reservations and all prudence, he had kept the bishop's candlesticks, worn mourning for him, sent for and questioned all the little Savoyards coming through, made inquiries about the families of Faverolles, and saved all Fauchelevent's life, despite the disturbing insinuations of Javert. It seems, as we have already remarked, that he thought along with all those who have ever been wise, holy, and just, that his first duty was not to himself. But, we have to say, nothing like this had ever come up before. Never had the two notions that ruled this unhappy man, whose sufferings are the subject of our tale, locked horns within himself in such a serious battle. He realized this dimly, but deeply, as soon as Javert had opened his mouth the day he came into his office. The instant that name, which he had buried under so many layers, was so weirdly voiced, he was struck dumb and sent reeling as though intoxicated by the sinister grotesqueness of his fate. And through the days, he felt the shudder that heralds huge quakes. He bent low, like an oak about to be battered by a storm, like a soldier about to be assailed. He felt darkness full of thunder and lightning directly overhead. While he was listening to Javert speak, he had had an initial impulse to dash out, to run, to denounce himself, to drag Champmathieu out of jail and put himself in. This had been painful and heartrending, like an incision in live flesh. And then it had passed, and he had said to himself, "Let's wait and see. Let's wait and see." He got this initial generous impulse under control and recoiled before such heroics. No doubt it would have been very nice if, after the sacred words of the bishop, after so many years of repentance and self-denial, in the middle of a penance so nobly undertaken, the man had not batted an eyelid for an instant, even when faced with such a terrible situation, and had gone on walking at the same pace toward the yawning chasm at the bottom of which lay heaven. That would have been very beautiful, but it is not what happened. It is, of course, our job to make known exactly what was going on in this man's soul, and we can only tell it the way it was. What won out at first was the instinct of self-preservation. He swiftly gathered his wits about him, stifled his emotions, considered that great peril the presence of Javert, postponed any decision with the firmness of terror, felt dizzy with all there was to do, and resumed his outward calmness as a gladiator picks up his shield. He remained in this state for the rest of the day, a tornado whirling within, profound calmness without. He took only what he might call precautionary measures. Everything was still confused and in turmoil in his brain. His brain was still so troubled that he could not latch on to any idea clearly, and he himself would have been hard-pressed to describe what was happening to him, except to say that he had just suffered quite a blow. He took himself off, as usual, to Fantine's sickbed, and stayed longer than usual out of an instinctual goodness, telling himself that this was how he should behave, and commended her earnestly to the sisters in case he should have to absent himself. He felt vaguely that he might be compelled to go to Arras, and, without being in the least determined to make the trip, he told himself that, being above all suspicion as he was, there was no harm in witnessing what would happen there. So he retained Scaufflaire's tilbury in order to be ready for any eventuality. He dined with a fairly good appetite. When he got back to his room, he gathered his wits about him again. He examined the situation and found it quite incredible. So incredible that in the middle of his reflections, he was moved by some mysterious and virtually inexplicable impulse of anxiety to get up from his chair and bolt the door. He was afraid something else might slip in, and so barricaded himself against the possibility. A moment later he blew out his light. It was getting on his nerves. It seemed to him that somebody could see him. Who could that be? Alas, the very thing he wanted to keep outside had entered. What he wanted to blind was looking at him. His conscience. His conscience, meaning God. Yet at first, he deluded himself. He felt safe and alone with the bolt in place. He felt impregnable. With the candle out, he felt invisible. And so he pulled himself together. He sat with his elbows on the table, held his head in his hands, and began to meditate in the darkness. Where am I? Am I sure I'm not dreaming? What was said? Is it true I saw that Javert and that he said what I think he said? Who can this Champmathieu be? Someone who looks like me? How can that be? When I think that only yesterday I was happy, and so far from having the faintest inkling. What was I doing this time yesterday? What is this all about? How will it turn out? What am I going to do? You can see what torment he was in. His brain had lost all power to retain ideas. They rushed through like waves, and he grabbed his forehead in both hands to try and stop them. This raging tumult shattered his will and his reason. He tried to extract some clarity and resolution from it, but all he came up with was anguish. His head was on fire. He went to the window and threw it wide open. There were no stars in the sky. He went and sat back down at the table. The first hour flew by. Little by little, however, dim outlines began to form and hold their shape in his mind, and he could perceive with the precision of reality not the situation in its entirety, but some of the details. He began by recognizing that, as extraordinary and critical as the situation was, he was completely in control of it. His bewilderment only grew. Independent of the strict religious goal his actions were directed toward, everything he had ever done till that day was nothing but a hole he had been digging in order to bury his name. What he had always most dreaded in his hours of turning on himself during his nights of insomnia was ever to hear that name spoken. He told himself that this would, for him, be the end of everything. That the day that name reappeared, it would cause his new life to vaporize around him, and, who knows, perhaps inside of him, his new soul. He shuddered at the very idea that this was possible. Certainly, if anyone had told him in those moments that a time would come when that name would resound in his ears again, when those hideous words, Jean Valjean, would shoot out of the dark and rear up before him, when that fearsome bolt from the blue, fated to dispel the mystery he had wrapped himself in, would suddenly turn into a circle of light and shine over his head, and that the name would not threaten him, that the light would produce only deeper darkness, that the torn veil would only intensify the mystery, that this earthquake would consolidate his edifice, that this prodigious event would have only the effect, if that's what he himself wished, of making his existence at once clearer and more impenetrable, and that from his confrontation with the phantom of Jean Valjean, the good and worthy bourgeois Monsieur Madeleine would emerge more honored, more at peace, and more respected than ever. If anyone had told him that, he would have shaken his head and dismissed such words as garbage. Well, all that was precisely what had just happened. This piling on of impossible events was a fact, and God had allowed such insanities to turn into realities. His musings grew clearer and clearer. He was able to take in his situation more and more. He felt as though he had just woken up from some strange sleep to find himself sliding down a slope in the middle of the night, on his feet, shivering, scrabbling backward in vain, on the extreme brink of an abyss. He could distinctly make out in the shadow a stranger that fate mistook for him and pushed into the gulf in his place. For the gulf to close up again, someone had to fall in. Himself or the other man. He had only to leave things alone. Suddenly, everything became clear, and he admitted this, that his place in the galleys was empty. That no matter what he did, it was still waiting for him, that robbing Petit Gervais led him straight back there, that the empty place was waiting for him and would pull at him until he was back in it, that this was inevitable and fatal. And then he said to himself that at that moment he had a substitute, that apparently a man named Champmathieu had the bad luck to be this substitute, and that, as for himself, present in jail from now on in the person of this Champmathieu, present in society, under the name of Monsieur Madeleine, he had nothing more to fear, as long as he did not prevent people from sealing upon Champmathieu's head the stone of infamy that, like the stone over the grave, falls once, never to rise again. All of this was so intensely violent and so strange that it created an indescribable commotion inside him that no one ever experiences more than two or three times in a lifetime. A sort of convulsion of your conscience that stirs up all the murky, dubious things the heart contains, which are composed of irony, joy, and despair. What we might call an inner burst of laughter. He promptly relit his candle. "Well, so what?" he said. "What am I so afraid of? Why go over it all again? I'm saved. It's over." There was only one door, still ajar, through which my past could erupt into my present life. That door is walled up now, forever. This Javert, who has been on my tail for so long, with his appalling instinct that seemed to have sniffed me out, that did sniff me out, for Christ's sake, the way he followed me everywhere. This ghoulish hound always nipping at my heels. Now he's been thrown off the scent. He's sniffing around elsewhere. Absolutely off the track. Now he's satisfied. He'll let me alone. He's got his Jean Valjean. Who knows? He probably even wants to leave town. And it all came about without my doing a thing. I had nothing to do with it. So then, what? What's so miserable about that? Anyone who saw me now would think something terrible had happened, for heaven's sake. After all, if anyone has come to grief, it's not my fault. It's all the work of fate. Apparently that's what fate wants. Do I have the right to undo the work of Providence? What am I after now? Why am I sticking my oar in? It's none of my business. Lord, I'm not happy. What's missing? The goal to which I've been aspiring for so many years. The one great dream that rules my nights. The object of my prayers to heaven above. Safety. Now I've got it. It's God's will. I've got no business interfering with God's will. And why does God will it? So I can carry on what I started, so I can do good, so that one day I can be a great and inspiring example, so that it can be said that there was at last a bit of happiness involved in this penance that I've undergone and in this virtue that I returned to. Really, I don't know why I was afraid just now to go and spill my guts to the good curé as my confessor, and to ask his advice. This is obviously what he would have told me. So, that's decided. Let things alone. Let God's will be done. He talked to himself in the depths of his conscience in this way, leaning over what we might call his own abyss. Then he got up from his chair and began to pace the room. So, he said, that's enough of that. A decision has been reached, and that settles that. But he felt no joy. Just the opposite. You can't stop your mind returning to an idea any more than you can stop the sea returning to shore. For the sailor, it is known as the tide. For the person with a guilty conscience, it is known as remorse. God lifts the soul as well as the ocean. After a few moments, try as he might, he was forced to resume the grim dialogue in which he was the one who both spoke and listened, saying what he wanted to keep quiet, listening to what he did not want to hear, yielding to that mysterious power that said to him, "Think," just as it said 2,000 years ago to another condemned man, "Walk." Before we go any further, and in the interests of being fully understood, we must insist on an essential observation. It is incontestable that we talk to ourselves. There is no thinking being who does not do so. We could even say that talk is never more of a magnificent mystery than when it travels within a person's inner life from mind to conscience and back again from conscience to mind. It's only in this sense that we should understand the words often used in this chapter, he said. He cried out. We say to ourselves, we talk to ourselves, we cry out inside ourselves, without the outer silence being broken. There is a great tumult. Everything in us speaks, except our mouths. The realities of the soul are no less real for not being visible and tangible. So he asked himself where he stood. He put himself through the third degree over this decision reached. He confessed to himself that everything he had just managed to get into order in his mind was monstrous, that to let things alone, to let God's will be done, was quite simply horrible. To let this mistake of fate and of men be perpetrated, not to stop it, to have a hand in the process through his silence, in a word, to do nothing, was to do everything. It was the final degree of hypocritical vileness. It was a crime, a low, cowardly, sly, abject, hideous crime. For the first time in 8 years, the poor man felt the bitter taste of wrongfulness. He spat it out in disgust. He continued to quiz himself. He asked himself sternly what he meant by the following phrase, "My goal has been achieved." He declared to himself that his life did indeed have a goal, but what goal? To hide his name? To hoodwink the police? Was it for something so petty that he had done all he had done? Didn't he have another goal, a big one, the true one? To save not his body, but his soul. To become honest and good again, to be a just man. Isn't that, especially that, uniquely that, what he had always wanted? What the bishop had demanded of him? To close the door on his past? But he wasn't closing it. For God's sake, he was opening it again by doing something despicable. He was reverting to being a thief again, and the most odious of thieves. He was robbing another of his existence, of his life, his peace of mind, his place under the sun. He was becoming a murderer. He was murdering some poor bastard, morally speaking. He was inflicting this ghastly, living death on him, this being buried alive, known as jail. On the contrary, to give himself up, to save this man struck by such a ghastly mistake, to take his name back, to become once more, out of duty, the convict Jean Valjean, that was truly to complete his resurrection and close forever the hell he had come from. To fall into it again, in appearance, was to leave it behind, in reality. He had to do it. He would have done nothing if he didn't do that. His whole life would have been useless, all his penitence wasted, and there would be only one thing left to say. What is the point? He felt that the bishop was there with him, that the bishop was even more present now that he was dead, that the bishop was watching him faithfully, that from now on the mayor Madeleine and all his virtues would be abhorrent to him, and that the galley slave Jean Valjean would be noble and pure in his sight. He felt that most people saw his mask, but that the bishop saw his face. That ordinary men saw his life, but the bishop saw his conscience. So he had to go to Arras, free the false Jean Valjean, denounce the true one. Alas! That was the greatest of sacrifices, the most moving of victories, the final step to take. But it had to be done. Painful fate. He would only enter into sanctity in the eyes of God if he re-entered infamy in the eyes of men. "So," he said, "my mind's made up. Let's do our duty. Let's save the man." He practically shouted those words, quite unaware that he was talking out loud. He gathered his books, checked them, and put them in order. He threw on the fire a bundle of letters of credit that he held over some small traders who had their backs to the wall. He wrote a letter, which he then sealed, and wrote an address on the envelope that you could have read, had you been in the room at the time. To Monsieur Lafitte, banker, Rue d'Artois at Paris. From a secretaire he pulled a wallet that held some banknotes and the passport he had used that same year to go to the elections. Anyone who had seen him perform these various actions, which had such a serious meditative underpinning, would not have had any idea what was going on inside him. Only, at times, his lips began to move. At other times he looked up and focused on some point on the wall as though it was precisely there that there was something he hoped to clear up or question. The letter to Monsieur Lafitte dealt with. He pocketed it along with the wallet and began pacing again. His reverie had not deviated. He continued to see his duty clearly written in luminous letters flaming before his very eyes and following his eyes around. Get going. Name yourself. Give yourself up. He also saw, as if they moved in front of him in perceptible form, the two ideas that till then had been the twin rules of his life. To hide his name, to sanctify his soul. For the first time, these imperatives seemed to him to be absolutely distinct, and he saw the difference that separated them. He recognized that one of these ideas was necessarily good, while the other could turn out to be bad. That the good idea was devotion, and the other, the cult of personality. That one idea said your neighbor, and the other said yourself. That one came from the light, and the other came from the darkness. They struggled with each other. He could see them fighting. The more he thought about it, the larger they grew in his mind's eye. They had now grown to colossal size. And it seemed to him that he was watching the titanic struggle inside himself, within that infinity we spoke of earlier, in the midst of darkness and light, between a god and a giant. He was full of horror. But it seemed to him that the good thought was winning. He felt that he was reaching the other decisive moment of his conscience and his fate, that the bishop had marked the first phase of his new life, and that this Champmathieu was marking the second. After a great crisis, a great test of strength. Yet the fever, for an instant quelled, gradually came over him again. A thousand thoughts flitted through him, but they only strengthened him in his resolve. One moment he told himself that he was perhaps taking things too hard, that after all this Champmathieu was of no interest, that he was, at the end of the day, a thief. He answered himself that if the man was in fact a thief, and had stolen a few apples, it meant a month in jail. That was a long way from the galleys. And who knows, anyhow? Did he actually steal? Was there any proof? The name Jean Valjean had battened down on him, seeming to dispense with any need for proof. Don't the king's prosecutors usually act in similar fashion? The man is believed to be a thief because he is known to be a convict. In another instant, the idea came to him that if he gave himself up, perhaps they would take into account the heroism of his action and his honest, upstanding life of the last 7 years and all he had done for the region, and pardon him. But this supposition evaporated pretty swiftly, and he smiled bitterly at the thought that the theft of those 40 sous from Petit Gervais made him a recidivist, that business would certainly raise its ugly head again and, in the precise terms of the law, would make him a candidate for forced labor for life. He turned away from all delusion, detached himself more and more from earthly things, and sought consolation and strength elsewhere. He told himself he had to do his duty, that he might even be no more unhappy after having done his duty than after having eluded it. That if he let well enough alone, if he remained in Montreuil-sur-Mer, his standing, his good reputation, his good works, the deference, the veneration, his charity, his wealth, his popularity, his virtue, would all be tainted by a crime. And what a taste all those sacred things would leave, tainted by something so vile. Whereas if he went ahead with his sacrifice and landed in jail, shackled to a post in an iron collar, with a green cap, doing hard labor till the end of his days, in relentless shame, there would be a touch of paradise involved. Lastly, he told himself that it was essential that this was his fate, that it was not for him to disturb the way things were arranged up above, that in any case he had to choose either virtue without and abomination within, or holiness within and disgrace on show without. In stirring up so many gloomy notions, his courage never failed him, but his brain hurt, and he began to think of other things in spite of himself, meaningless things. His blood was pounding violently in his temples. He was still pacing to and fro. First midnight rang out from the parish church, then from the mairie. He counted the 12 strokes from the 2 clocks and compared the sound of the 2 bells. He remembered as he did so that only a few days before he had seen at a scrap merchant's an old clock for sale on which this name was written, Antoine Albin de Romainville. He was cold. He lit a small fire. It didn't occur to him to shut the window. Even so, he fell once more into a stupor. He had to make a huge effort to recall what on earth he'd been thinking before midnight sounded. He finally remembered. Ah, yes, he said to himself. I decided to give myself up. All of a sudden he thought of Fantine. Wait a minute, he said. What about that poor woman? At this juncture, a new crisis erupted. Fantine, appearing suddenly in his inner debate, was like a ray of light shining where it was least expected. It seemed to him that everything around him looked different suddenly, and he cried out, "Of course! Till now I've been thinking only of myself. I've only considered what suits me. It suits me either to keep quiet or to give myself up, to hide myself or to save my soul, to be a magistrate, despicable but respected, or a galley slave, disgraced but noble. It's all about me, 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 nothing but me." But good God, talk about sheer egotism. Different forms of egotism, but egotism just the same. How about thinking of others for a change? The first sacred duty is to think of one's neighbor. Let's see, let's have a closer look. Myself accepted, myself eliminated, myself left out of the picture. What happens with all of this? If I give myself up, they nab me, they let this Charmantier go, they stick me back in the galleys. Right, and then what? What happens here? Ah. Here there is a region, a town, factories, a whole industry, workers, men, women, old grandfathers, children, poor people. I created all that. I keep all that going. Wherever there's a chimney smoking, I'm the one who puts the log in the fire and the meat in the pot. I've created ease of living, movement, credit. Before me there was nothing. I got things going again, brought things to life, put some spark back into things, invigorated, stimulated, enriched the whole place. With me gone, the soul is gone. If I take myself off, everything will die. And that woman who has suffered so much, who was so noble in her fall from grace, I was the cause of her downfall, albeit unwittingly. And what about the child I was about to go and get? I promised her mother. Don't I also owe something to this woman by way of reparation for the harm I've done her? If I disappeared, what would happen? The mother would die. The little girl would have to fend for herself. So that's exactly what would happen if I give myself up. What if I don't give myself up? Let's see. If I don't give myself up? After putting this question to himself, he stopped. He experienced a momentary hesitation and trembling, but the moment was soon over, and he answered himself calmly. Well, that man goes to the galleys, that's true, but what the hell, he did steal. There's no point in my pretending he didn't steal. He stole, all right. Me, I stay here. I carry on. In 10 years, I'll have earned 10 million. I give it back to the community. I keep nothing myself. What's it to me? It's not for myself that I do what I do. The prosperity of all grows. Old industries crank up and expand. New manufacturers and workshops mushroom. Families, 100 families, 1,000 families, are happy. The countryside gets peopled. Villages spring up where there are only farms. Farms spring up where there's nothing. Poverty disappears. And with poverty, debauchery. prostitution, theft, murder, all the vices, all the crimes disappear too. And that poor mother can bring up her daughter. And the whole region is rich and honest. For heaven's sake, I must have been mad. I must have been completely brain sick. Why on earth would I talk about giving myself up? I really had better pull myself together. This demands careful reflection. I really mustn't do anything hasty. Good Lord, just because I fancied playing the great and the generous man. Talk about melodrama, for God's sake, because I was only thinking of myself. Myself alone. Good Lord. And all to save, who knows who, some thief. Obviously a scoundrel. And from a punishment that might be a tad excessive, but is no doubt justified at bottom. And for such a man, the whole region must go to the dogs. A poor woman must croak in the hospital, a poor little girl must croak by the roadside like dogs. Ah, now that's abominable, if you want abominable, without the mother even sighting her child again. Without the child even knowing a thing about her mother. And all for this old bastard of an apple thief who, beyond any doubt, deserves the galleys for something else, if not for that. What fine scruples. To save a man who's guilty and sacrifice the innocent. To save some old vagrant who's only got a few more years left in him when all's said and done, and who wouldn't be any worse off in the galleys than he would be at home in his hovel. To sacrifice a whole population, mothers, women, children. Poor little Cosette, who has only me in the world, and who is no doubt, at this very moment, completely blue with cold in the glorified shack of those Thénardiers. There's some more riffraff for you, that lot. So I'm supposed to fail in my duty of care toward all those poor creatures. And I'm supposed to go and turn myself in. Imagine doing anything so damned stupid. Let's look at the worst that can happen. Let's suppose that in all this there is a bad deed on my part and that my conscience holds it against me one day. All we have to do is accept for the good of others such disapprobation as burdens me alone. This bad deed that compromises my soul alone, that's what devotion is. That's where virtue lies. He got to his feet and began pacing again. This time it seemed to him that he was happy. Diamonds are found only in the bowels of the earth. Truths are found only in the depths of reflection. It seemed to him that having descended into those depths, after groping in the blackness of the shadows for so long, he had finally found one of those diamonds, one of those truths, and that he held it in his hand, and it blinded him to look at it. Yes, he thought, that's it. I'm on the road to the truth. I've found the solution. You have to end up holding on to something. I've made my choice. Let well enough alone. No more vacillating, no more retreating. This is in everyone's interest, not just mine. I am Madeleine, and Madeleine I remain. Too bad for the fellow who is Jean Valjean. He is no longer me. I don't know the man. I don't know what he is anymore. If there is someone who is Jean Valjean at this moment, let him fend for himself. It's nothing to do with me. It's a fateful name that floats in the night. If it stops and falls on someone's head, too bad for that person. He looked at himself in the little mirror over the mantelpiece and said, "See? What a relief to come to a decision. I look completely different now." He took another few steps and then stopped short. "Wake up to yourself," he said. "You can't go back no matter what the consequences of the decision you've made. There are still a few ties that bind me to this Jean Valjean. They must be cut. Here in this very room, there are a few objects that would point the finger at me, dumb things that would accuse me. Make no bones about it, they have to go." He felt around in his pocket, pulled out his purse, opened it, and took out a small key. He fitted the key into a lock, though the keyhole was barely visible, lost as it was in the darkest shades of the design of the wallpaper on the wall. A little secret space opened, a sort of false cupboard set between the wall and the mantelpiece. There was nothing in this little hidden space but junk. A smock made of blue cloth, an old pair of pants, an old haversack, and a big thorn stick, tipped with metal at both ends. those who had seen Jean Valjean in the days when he was passing through Digne, in October 1815, would easily have recognized all the components of this miserable fancy dress. He had kept them just as he had kept the silver candlesticks, to remind himself always of where he had come from. Only he hid what had come from jail and left out in the open the candlesticks that had come from the bishop. He cast a furtive glance at the door as though he feared it might open despite the bar that held it shut tight. Then, with an abrupt and violent move, he grabbed in a single armful, without so much as a quick glance at them, these things he had so religiously and perilously hoarded for so many years, and took the lot, rags, stick, haversack, and threw them on the fire. He shut the false cupboard again, and, taking further precautions now, rather pointlessly, since the thing was empty, he hid the door behind a heavy piece of furniture, which he pushed in front of it. After a few seconds, the room and the wall opposite were lit by a great, flickering red reflection. It was all going up in flames. The thorn stick crackled and threw out sparks right to the middle of the room. The haversack, as it went up along with the awful rags it held, exposed something gleaming in the ashes. If you bent over, you would easily have recognized a silver coin. No doubt, the 40-sou piece stolen from the little Savoyard. He did not watch the fire. He walked, pacing to and fro in the same steady rhythm. All of a sudden his eyes fell on the two silver candlesticks that the light set gleaming faintly on the mantelpiece. "Hang on," he thought. "The whole of Jean Valjean is there, still in them. They must be destroyed too." He grabbed the two candlesticks. There was enough of a fire to swiftly deform them and melt them down into a sort of unrecognizable ingot. He bent down to the hearth and warmed himself there for a moment. "Nice and hot," he said. He stirred the coals with one of the candlesticks. A minute more and they'd have been in the fire. At that instant he seemed to hear a voice crying out inside him, "Jean Valjean! Jean Valjean!" His hair stood on end. He froze as though he'd heard something terrible. "Yes, that's it. Finish the job," said the voice. "Finish what you've started. Destroy the candlesticks. Obliterate the memory. Forget the bishop. Forget everything. Sink this Champmathieu character. Go on. That's right. Give yourself a round of applause. That way it's fixed. It's resolved. It's done. Here's a fella, an old man, who doesn't know what they've got against him, who has possibly done nothing, an innocent, whose undoing is entirely due to your name. Your name is weighing on him like a crime. And he will be taken for you. He will be condemned. He will end his days in utter humiliation and in horror. Never mind. You be an upright man. You keep on being Monsieur le Maire. Keep on being honorable and honored. Play the hero. Make the town rich. Feed the poor. Bring up orphans. Live happily ever after. Virtuous and admired. And during that time, while you're here living in joy and in the light, someone else will have your red shirt on. Someone else will bear your name in ignominy and drag your chain in jail. Yes, that's all settled nicely then. Ah, miserable bastard." Sweat trickled down his forehead. He fixed wild eyes on the candlesticks. But whatever was talking inside him had not yet done with him. The voice went on. "Jean Valjean, there will be many voices around you that will make a lot of noise, that will clamor and shout, that will bless you. And one voice that no one will hear and that will curse you in the darkness. So then hear this, you vile creature. All the blessings will fall away before they reach heaven, and only the curse will rise as far as God." This voice, at first quite weak, and coming from the darkest recess of his conscience, had gradually become strident and frightening, and he now heard it in his ear. It seemed to him that it had come from inside him, but that it was now talking from outside him. He felt he heard those last words so distinctly that he looked around the room in a sort of terror. "Is there someone there?" he asked out loud, perfectly distraught. Then he went on with a laugh that sounded like the laugh of a half-wit. "What an idiot I am! There can't be anybody there. There was someone there. But that someone was not among those the human eye can see. He put the candlesticks back down on the mantelpiece. Then he began the monotonous and grim pacing that troubled the dreams of the man below him and woke him with a start from his sleep. Walking calmed him and excited him at the same time. It seems that in extreme situations we often move around to ask the advice of all we might encounter in our travels. After a few moments, he no longer knew where he was. He now recoiled in equal horror from each of the decisions he had in turn made. The two ideas counseling him both seemed as disastrous as each other. What a fatal coincidence! What a turn of events, this Champmathieu being taken for him! To be mown down by the means Providence seemed to have used initially to bolster him. There was a moment when he considered the future. Give himself up? Great God, turn himself in? He saw with immense despair all that he would have to leave, all that he would have to go through again. He would then have to say goodbye to this existence that was so good, so pure, so radiant, to the respect of all, to honor, to freedom. He would go no more into the fields to stroll. He would no longer hear the birds singing in the month of May. He would no longer hand out alms to the little children. He would no longer feel the looks of gratitude and love that settled on him. He would leave this house he had built, this room, this sweet little room. Everything looked lovely to him at that moment. He would no longer read from these books. He would no longer write from this little whitewood table. His old concierge, the only servant he had, would no longer bring up his coffee in the morning. Great God! Instead of that, the galley slaves, the shackles, the red shirt, the iron chain on his foot, the exhaustion, the dungeon, the camp bed, all the old familiar horrors. At his age, after having been what he was, if only he were still young, but fancy being old and insulted by the first person to come along, to be searched by the galley guard, to be belted by the guard with a truncheon, to have his bare feet in ironclad shoes, to hold out his leg morning and night for the hammer of the geezer who does the rounds testing the fetters, to have to put up with the curiosity of strangers to whom they would say, "That one there, that's the famous Jean Valjean who used to be mayor of Montreuil-sur-Mer." At night, dripping with sweat, shattered by fatigue, the green cap over his eyes, to mount two by two under the sergeant's whip the gangway of that floating prison. Oh, what misery! Can destiny, then, be malevolent like an intelligent being, and turn monstrous like the human heart? Do what he might, he kept returning to this thorny dilemma at the back of his mind, whether to remain in paradise and turn into a demon there, or to return to hell and there become an angel. What to do, great God, what to do? The torment he'd struggled so painfully free of unleashed itself once more inside him. His ideas began to get tangled up again. They assumed that indefinably dazed, mechanical quality peculiar to despair. The name Romainville kept endlessly recurring along with two lines of a song he'd once heard. He thought that Romainville was a small wood close to Paris where young lovers went to gather lilacs in the month of April. He tottered without as within. He stumbled around like a toddler finally allowed to walk on his own two feet. Now and then, fighting off his weariness, he made an effort to think straight. He struggled to put into words, finally and once and for all, the problem over which he now stumbled with exhaustion. Should he give himself up? Should he keep quiet? He couldn't manage to see anything clearly. The vague outlines of all the arguments he'd sketched in his mind trembled and broke up, one after the other, all went up in smoke. Only he felt that whatever side he opted for, necessarily and without his being able to escape it, something of himself would die. That he was entering a tomb. and whether he took the left turn or the right, he would undergo the final agony of death, the demise of his happiness, or the demise of his virtue. Alas, he was in the grip once more of a total lack of resolve. He was right back to square one. And so, this sorry soul went on debating with himself in anguish. 1800 years before this poor wretched man, the mysterious being in whom all the holiness and all the suffering of humanity are gathered, had also, while the olive trees were shivering in the wild wind of infinity, long pushed away with his hand the fearsome chalice that appeared to him, streaming shadow and running over with darkness in the star-filled depths. Forms suffering takes during sleep. 3 o'clock in the morning had just rung out, and he had been pacing up and down for 5 hours, almost without let-up, when he let himself sink into his chair. There he fell asleep, and had a dream. This dream, like most dreams, was only connected to the actual situation by something mysteriously forlorn and poignant, but it made an impression on him. The nightmare struck him so forcefully, he later wrote it down. It is one of the notes written in his own hand that he left behind. We believe we should transcribe the thing verbatim here. Whatever the dream, the story of that night would be incomplete if we left it out. It is the somber adventure of a sick soul. Here it is. On the envelope we find written this line: "The dream I dreamed that night. I was in the countryside somewhere. Wide open, gloomy country where there was no grass. It didn't look like day or night as far as I could tell. I was having a walk with my brother, the brother I had in my childhood, the brother I have to say I never think of, and whom I hardly remember anymore. We were chatting, and we met others out walking. We were talking about a neighbor we once had who, ever since she'd moved into the street, used to always work with her window open. While we were chatting, we got cold because of the open window. There were no trees in the countryside. We saw a man go past, completely naked, the color of ash, mounted on a horse the color of dirt. The man had no hair. You could see his skull and the veins on his skull. He was holding a stick in his hand that was as flexible as a vine shoot and as heavy as iron. The horseman rode past and didn't say a thing to us. My brother said to me, 'Let's take the sunken lane.' There was a sunken lane where you never saw a single bush or patch of moss. Everything was the color of dirt, even the sky. After a few steps, no one answered me when I spoke. I realized my brother was no longer with me. I walked into a village I saw. I thought it must be Romainville. Why Romainville? The first street I went into was deserted. I took a second street. At the corner where the two streets met, a man was standing with his back against a wall. I said to this man, 'What is this place? Where am I?' The man didn't answer. I saw the door of a house open, and I went in. The first room was deserted. I went into the second. Behind the door of this room there was a man standing against the wall. I asked this man, 'Whose house is this? Where am I?' The man didn't answer. The house had a garden. I went out of the house and into the garden. The garden was deserted. Behind the first tree I found a man standing. I said to this man, 'What is this garden? Where am I?' The man didn't answer. I wandered about the village and I saw that it was a town. All the streets were deserted, all the doors were open. Not one living being passed in the streets or walked in the rooms or strolled about the gardens. But behind every corner of wall, behind every door, behind every tree, there was a man standing who held his tongue. You never saw more than one of them at a time. These men watched me going past. I left the town and began to walk through the fields. After a while, I turned round, and I saw a great crowd coming behind me. I recognized all the men that I'd seen in the town. They had strange heads. They didn't seem to be in any hurry, and yet they were walking faster than I was. They didn't make a sound as they walked. In an instant, the mob had caught up with me and surrounded me. The faces of the men were the color of dirt. Then the first man I saw and questioned when I entered the town said to me, "Where are you going? Don't you know you've been dead a long time?" I opened my mouth to reply and realized there was no one around me. He woke up. He was freezing. A wind as cold as the early morning was causing the window, which was still open, to rock and rattle in its frame. The fire had gone out. The candle was burned virtually to the bottom. It was still the dead of night. He got up and went to the window. There were still no stars in the sky. From his window he could see the courtyard in front of the house and the street. A hard, dry sound that rang out suddenly from the ground made him look down. He saw below him two red stars whose rays flickered long and short, bizarrely, in the dark. As his mind was still submerged in the fog of his dream, "Hang on," he thought. "There aren't any stars in the sky, now they're on the ground." But this confusion swiftly cleared, and a second noise, like the first, managed to wake him up. He peered out and he recognized that the two stars were the lanterns of a carriage. In the light they threw out, he could make out the shape of the carriage. It was a tilbury, attached to a small white horse. The noise he had heard was the horse's hooves stamping on the pavement. "What the hell is that carriage doing here?" he wondered. "Who's turned up so early in the morning?" At that moment, someone knocked gently on the door of his room. He shivered from head to toe and cried out in a frightening voice, "Who's there?" Someone answered, "Me, Monsieur le Maire." He recognized the voice of the old woman, his concierge. "Well," he said, "what's wrong?"
"Monsieur le Maire, it's just on 5 o'clock."
"What do I care?"
"Monsieur le Maire, the cabriolet is here."
"What cabriolet?"
"The tilbury."
"What tilbury?"
"Didn't Monsieur le Maire ask for a tilbury?"
"No," he said.
"The driver says he's come for Monsieur le Maire."
"What driver?"
"Monsieur Scoffler's driver."
"Monsieur Scoffler?" The name made him flinch, as though a streak of lightning had flashed in his face.
"Ah, yes," he said. "Monsieur Scoffler."
If the old woman could have seen him at that moment, she would have been terrified. There was a rather long silence. He studied the flame of the candle, with his mouth hanging open like an imbecile, and he pinched some of the molten wax around the wick and rolled it in his fingers. The old woman waited. Then she took the risk of raising her voice a little.
"Monsieur le Maire, what am I supposed to say?"
"Say everything's fine, and I'll be right down." A spoke in the wheels. The postal service between Arras and Montreuil-sur-Mer was still conducted at that time by little mail coaches dating from the days of the Empire. These mail coaches were two-wheeled cabriolets, upholstered inside in tawny buckskin. They were suspended on pump springs and had just two seats, one for the mailman, the other for the traveler. The wheels were fitted with those offensive long hubs that keep other cabs at a distance and that you can still see on the roads of Germany today. The chest for the mail was a huge oblong box stuck behind the carriage and coupled with it. This chest was painted black and the carriage yellow. You don't see anything like those carriages these days. There was something deformed and humped about them, and whenever you saw them trundling by in the distance or crawling along some road on the horizon, they looked like those insects known, I think, as termites, which have skinny thoraxes that drag great abdomens along behind them. Yet they got along at quite a clip. The mail coach left Arras every night at 1, after the mail from Paris had passed, and arrived in Montreuil-sur-Mer a bit before 5 in the morning. That particular night, just as the mail coach that went down into Montreuil-sur-Mer by the Hesdin Road was turning the corner and coming into town, it ran into a little tilbury pulled by a white horse going in the opposite direction, and with just one person in it, a man wrapped up in a coat. The tilbury's wheel took quite a shock. The mailman shouted to the man to stop, but the traveller wouldn't hear of it and went on his way at a rapid trot.
"There's a man with only a minute to live," said the mailman to himself.
The man hurrying away was the same man we've just seen wrestling with himself in convulsions surely worthy of pity. Where was he going? He could not have said. Why was he in such a hurry? He did not know. He was moving forward, aimlessly. Where to? To Arras, no doubt. But maybe he was going somewhere else, too. At times he thought so, and he shuddered. He sank into the darkness as though sliding down into a yawning chasm. Something was pushing him, something was pulling him. What was going on inside him, no one could have said, yet anyone could understand. What man has not, at least once in his life, plummeted into that dark cave of the unknown? Besides, he had resolved nothing, decided nothing, stopped nothing, done nothing. None of his acts of conscience had been definitive. More than ever, he was back where he began. Why was he going to Arras? He went back over what he had already told himself when he booked the cabriolet from Scaufflaire, that whatever the consequences might be, it wouldn't hurt to see things with his own eyes, judge things for himself, that this was only prudent. In fact, that he had to know what would happen, that he couldn't make any decision without having observed and scrutinized. That a person made mountains out of molehills at a distance, that at the end of the day, when he'd seen this Champmathieu, whatever the poor bastard was, his conscience would probably be only too relieved to see him carted off to the clink in his stead. That in all likelihood Javert would be there, and Brevet, and Chenildieu, and Cochepaille, ex-convicts who had known him, but that they would certainly not recognize him. Ha! The very idea that Javert was way off the scent, that all conjectures and suppositions were pinned on this Champmathieu, and that nothing could be harder to shift than suppositions and conjectures. And so, that there was no real danger. He also thought that it was undoubtedly a dark hour, but that he would get through it. That, after all, he held his fate, however bad it might be, in his hands. That he was the master of it. He clung to that thought. At bottom, if the truth be known, he'd have preferred not to go to Arras. Yet that's where he was going. Turning things over all the while, he whipped the horse, which was trotting along at a strong and steady pace that enabled them to make 2.5 leagues an hour. The further the cabriolet went, the more he felt something inside him shrink. At daybreak he was in the open countryside. The town of Montreuil-sur-Mer was far enough behind him. He watched the horizon whiten. He watched, without seeing, all the chilling features of a winter dawn passing before his eyes. Morning has its ghosts just as night does. He did not see them, but unwittingly, and through almost a kind of physical osmosis, the black silhouettes of trees and hills added something inexpressibly mournful and sinister to the convulsive state of his soul. Every time he passed one of those secluded houses that sometimes sit right next to the road, he said to himself, "You wouldn't credit it, and yet there are people in there sleeping." The horse's trot, the harness bells, the wheels on the pavement, had a soft, monotonous sound. Such things are lovely when you are full of joy, and forlorn as can be when you are downhearted. It was broad daylight by the time he reached Hesdin. He pulled up in front of an inn to let the horse get his breath and get him some oats. The horse was, as Scaufflaire had said, one of the small-sized Boulonnais breed with too much of a head, too much of a gut and not enough of a neck, but with an open chest, a good wide rump, a fine, neat leg, and a firm foot.